Welcome to another in a series of News Gazette podcasts. I am News Gazette columnist Jim Dye, and during this hour, we're going to explore the details of one of the strangest stories ever to come out of the city of Chicago. It involves murder, political intrigue, Illinois' death penalty law, allegedly dishonest journalism at Northwestern University, outstanding journalism by people like my guest, and a lot of big and powerful people who had a lot to lose if all the facts ever came out, which, in this case, they most assuredly will not.
Hey, Jim Rosso, News Gazette Media, reminding you that at newsgazette.com, we have a ton of podcasts every week, from Brian Barnhart's Penny for Your Thoughts, to Scott Beatty's News Hour, to Elizabeth Hess, Dave Gentry, talking with movers and shakers on their morning show. Head to newsgazette.com and search for podcasts.
My guest is former Chicago Tribune reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner, Bill Crawford. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. Good to have you here with us.
I am with you, and I appreciate the introduction.
Well, you got a big job today because you're going to explain this incredibly messy 40-year saga. So let me just give you a little intro on the facts here, and then I'm going to give you almost complete authority to filibuster.
All
so
right.
Here we go. This story began in 1982 with a routine, by Chicago standards, double murder allegedly committed by William Porter. By the time it was over, the guilty man, Porter, was released from prison and replaced in prison by an innocent man who then began a long journey of his own to win his release. So, Bill, if you were talking to someone who knew nothing about the William Porter all-story Simon mess, how would you sum it up?
Well, you know, it is practically impossible to sum up briefly, but let me just give you a little framework, a general framework of what happened, and some of it is going to repeat what you just mentioned. But it goes like this. This case is universally known as the Anthony Porter / El Story Simon case. The story, which dragged on for years, is one of the most unusual criminal court cases ever to have unfolded in the history of the Cook County criminal court system. I mean, there is just no question about that. It also represents one of the most egregious upendings of criminal justice in the history of the largest consolidated criminal court system in the country, that is, Cook County. The saga takes more twists and turns than an alpine pass, so to assist the listener in getting a handle on this narrative, and I'm not going to be long with this, it is imperative to give the listener a brief sketch of the framework in which this unconscionable tragedy unfolded. On August 15, 1982, a young man by the name of Jerry Hillard and his fiancée, Marilyn Green, who was the mother of two toddlers at the time, were sitting high in the bleachers overlooking the Chicago Park District's Washington Park swimming pool on the far south side of Chicago at about 1 a.m. It was a sultry, starlit night when a man by the name of Anthony Porter, who had an incredible rap sheet, as it turned out, four or five pages long, involving just about every crime imaginable, he entered the pool, which by Park District rules was closed at sundown and therefore should have been closed at 1 in the morning, but police generally looked the other way as long as there was no accounts of trouble. And at that point, there had been no accounts of trouble. And by the way, this meeting in the pool was attended by, I don't know, 30 or 40 different individuals, adults, younger kids, teenagers, and so on. And it came right on the heels of the Bud Billiken Day Parade, which is a famous, largely African-American parade, which occurs every August in Chicago. So Porter ascends the bleachers, pulls out a handgun, and at point-blank range, he fatally shot the couple, both of whom were pronounced dead on arrival at two nearby hospitals. Robbery at the time was suspected as the motive behind the shooting. Within 48 hours, Porter surrendered to police after learning that a half dozen witnesses, also in the pool at the time, had identified him in mugshot police books and in lineups as the trigger man. I mean, there was just no dispute. And I must say, during this 48-hour period, at no time was the name El Story Simon ever uttered by anybody. Not a peep. So after the 48 hours, Porter, you know, learns that he's being looked for by the police. So he surrenders. He was, after some questioning by additional witnesses and other investigative work by the police, he was charged with a double homicide, tried by a jury of his peers, convicted by a jury of his peers, and of the double murder, and was sentenced to death.
And that was in 1983.
Now,
can I just,
I'm sorry?
Can I stop you for a second here?
Surely.
Okay. By the way, I said earlier, I said William Porter, which is Anthony Porter. Every now and then I get these brain glitches. I want to give somebody a different name. But anyhow, wasn't he also convicted of a armed robbery subsequent to the double murder?
Well, you know, I didn't want to make the intro too long, but let me tell you this. Yes, 2 weeks before this double homicide occurs in the pool, it is high noon. It is two blocks away from the pool murder scene. He's on the street. He sees a man whom he does not know. That man is walking his dog, and Porter kicks the dog for no apparent reason whatsoever. The owner of the dog complains. Porter disappears into a nearby building, reemerges with a loaded 38, and shoots the man in the head. The man survives. Porter is arrested. This is in broad daylight, and he's charged with attempted murder. And as a consequence of that arrest, he was sentenced to 6 years. But let me just finish this intro very quickly. After he was convicted 6 years for the one and sentenced to death for the double homicide, for the next 19 years, the death penalty being what it is in this state and many others, he was on death row for 19 years, awaiting the arrival of the executioner. Now, at one point in 1998, and remember, the murder occurred in 1982, he has finally exhausted all of his appeals, and he is literally 15 hours away from being executed when David Protes, and that's a very important name.
That's right. That's one of the key figures.
Heralded, now disgraced, former professor in Northwestern University's fabled Medill School of Journalism, stepped into the case along with several of his students, a small-time detective who was working with Protes,
it's Paul
a criminal
Cialino.
Defense attorney who was working with Protes, and others. They entered into the case and turned it on its head. The result of their stepping into the case, and this is where things really get involved, Porter ultimately was freed in 1999 from prison and ultimately pardoned for the double homicide by then-Governor George Ryan. And that all happened as a consequence of the interference of the upending of justice that was headed by Protes and cooperated in by many of his allies. And, again, because of the Porter interference at all, and because of the Stark conspiracy affected by Protes, El Story Simon, the man who was never mentioned as even being in the pool, he was never mentioned in Porter's trial. He's mentioned in no police reports. He, in turn, is sentenced to 37 years in prison for the double homicide committed in 1982 by El Story Simon. End of intro.
Okay. Now, let's just back up a little bit. You know, you talked about Porter being on death row and at one point coming within a number of hours of being executed, and then all of a sudden Protes making this dramatic entry into the case. But there was a history of Protes and his journalism students being involved in these cases that gave them a certain amount of credibility. Can you talk about David Protes and his, I guess we'd call it his participation in the Innocence Project, so to speak?
Yes, yes. You know, he was, over time, he was growing in fame for this kind of work, renown for this kind of work. And there were three or four other cases which were high profile. They got a lot of press. And they're very involved, and we'd be here forever to talk about
it. Sure, but he was, but he achieved his goals of.
I'm sorry.
But he achieved his goals of turning people who were convicted free.
Of casting these people in an innocent light, and probably the most infamous of them all, other than the Anthony Porter, El Story Simon case, is the so-called Ford Heights 4 case.
Mm-hmm.
Now, without getting into the specifics on that, because I'd be here for 3 days,
yeah.
What had happened is four individuals kidnapped a fiancé and her boyfriend and transported them to a rundown area of Ford Heights, which was not a pretty community by any means, marched them into an abandoned rundown building, and the four individuals, all male, took turns over a 3 or 4 hour period raping the woman while holding the boyfriend at bay in the basement under armed guard. When they'd finished with whatever it was they were doing, the woman, pleading for her life, said, "Please don't harm me." They shot her in the head. She died immediately. And the other man was taken to the backyard of one of these rundown buildings, and he, too, was murdered. But it was kind of – that was almost a landmark case for Porter – or for protests. And
so he
again,
has – so he
through
has
sleights of hand and through tinkering with evidence, and it's in the record, he got these people a hearing, and this is after they'd been in prison for about 30 years. All four of them are popped loose as a consequence of protesters' interference, and they settled for $37 million with Cook County because of a wrongful conviction. And when you, again, when you look at the underlying testimony in that case, you not only come away feeling ill, literally, again, you can see clearly the wrong that had been committed by Northwestern to affect this wrongful freedom.
Okay, so basically protest is riding on a wave of this kind of popular acclaim of being the superstar reporter who frees innocent men. And so by the time he gets involved with Porter, he's got this credibility, and he says, "Hey, I found the real, not only have I discovered he's innocent, I have the guilty man for you all wrapped up in a blanket, and you can just take it from here." I should also mention before I go any further that while I've written a number of columns about this thing, you have actually written a book about it, and it's a very good book. It's called Justice Perverted, How the Innocence Project at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism Sent an Innocent Man to Prison. The thing about this book that's very impressive, not only is the fact that it's extremely readable, but the documentation, or should I say the attribution for the reporting is basically all comes from official records. So this is there's a lot in the records to work with for a reporter that might have, had it been handled differently, might have led to a different result in this case.
All the report, I'm telling you, I even told reporters, practically begged them, to sit down and look at key documents underlying the Porter-Simon case. And I am telling you, I looked at literally 99.99% of the entire underlying record. But I am also telling you that there are essentially four key documents. And again, it's tough to get into them, but there are four key documents, all triggered by sworn testimony under oath. And if one were to read those four documents, and particularly the trial transcript of Porter, which I'd like to mention in a minute, one comes away with one conclusion, one inescapable conclusion, and that is that Simon was innocent and Porter indeed killed these two people.
Okay. Well, let's see. We've got Porter sitting in the slam, and we've got All Story Simon as a free man living in Milwaukee or whatever. And David Protest decides, based on a name he came across, that All Story Simon is the guy that he should be looking at. And so How does he arrange to get this really interesting confession from All Story Simon? You want to tell that story?
So it goes like this. If you look, and going forward, by the way, if you look at Porter's or Protest's entire work in this neck of the woods, you will see, and he will claim that he was responsible for, and his work and his colleagues were responsible for springing free maybe 8, 9, 10, 11 individuals who had wrongfully been convicted. If you also look at those 8, 9, 10, 11 cases, you will see a pattern that is undeniable. Number one, they go to cases that are 20 and 30 years old. Now let's take Porter, for example. He gets convicted in 93, and in
82 was the murder.
Crime was committed in 82. He gets convicted in 83, and he's released in 99. They go, all of these cases go way, way back, and what happens, and the conduct is practically uniform, and you will see it again if you look at the underlying record. He sends out these students who go to witnesses who originally testified, again, 20 and 30 years earlier, some of them very young. And they go back, and by the way, through artful techniques, which we can get into, they convince these original witnesses, many of whom had testified at trial, all of whom had given signed, sworn affidavits to the police at the time, they change their testimony. And the students and Cialino, the detective, draft new affidavits saying, in effect, I was in error. I said the wrong thing. I have now changed my mind. And they write up a new affidavit. And they get not just one. Sometimes they'll get 5, 7, 8, 9 of these affidavits. Then 19, 20 years later, 30 years later, they come back before a judge in Cook County and say, Your Honor, I think you got the wrong man. And through some arduous work before the judge, they convince the judge that a rehearing is warranted on the man that was convicted 30 years ago, just like they did with Porter. And he gets a hearing, and all these new affidavits are filed with the court. All this new testimony comes in, which has now been altered 180 degrees from the original testimony. And the judge says, well, you know what? I'm going to let the guy go. I think maybe he got ramrodded.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Protests and his, shall we say, his creative techniques of getting people to say what he wants them to say. Now, there's not any speculation about this because he actually wrote a book in which he talked about the methods by which he would persuade or trick or however you want to characterize it, people to change their testimony. Didn't he had people pretend to be police officers? Didn't Cialino, didn't he pretend to be a police officer? And weren't there also discussions about, well, this is going to be a big story someday, and if you participate with us, there's going to be a big payoff down the road? Those kinds of things?
Yes, and a classic example of that is what happened in the Porter Simon case. Excuse me. Cialino, El Story Simon at the time is living in Milwaukee, and he's been up there for years after the 1982 shooting. And he goes up there for his own reasons. But anyway, he's up there. It's now 1999. They are deep in trying to persuade a judge to give a hearing to Porter to demonstrate that indeed he had been wrongfully convicted. As that hearing approaches, Cialino jumps in his car in Chicago with another private eye who is now deceased. They go up to El Story Simon's house. They all but kick, very early in the morning, they all but kick in the front door of the house. El Story Simon, and he will acknowledge it, and it's in the book, is coming off a night of heavy drinking and snorting coke. He's completely disoriented. He has no clue what is going on. And suddenly two individuals are in his living room, armed to the teeth, and both of them identify themselves as Chicago policemen. They then say that a double homicide was committed in 1982, that they have a witness who is prepared to testify that indeed El Story Simon pulled the trigger and that Porter is innocent of that crime.
And they have a video.
They then slap a videotape in a video machine. They push the button, and there is this black man, very articulately enunciating how he was in the park in 1982. He was in the pool area of the park in 1982. He saw Simon climb the bleachers. He saw Simon pull out a 38. He saw Simon shoot both of his victims at point-blank range and race from the pool. And
who was that witness?
He was an actor.
That's pretty good.
He was an actor. So
everything they're showing Simon was false.
Then they tell him two other things that are very critical. A, if you do not confess to this crime right now to us, number one, you're looking at the death penalty. That's number one. Number two, three things. Number two, if you plead guilty, you're going to only do 2 years in prison. And the reason you're going to do only 2 years in prison, and this is Cialino's own statements, is because David Protes, who has immense clout with the judicial system back in Cook County, is going to see to it that you only do 2 years. So after 2 years, you're going to be a free man. But here is the coup de grace. When you are out, the money that is going to accrue to you from book rights, movie rights, and all other kinds of publicity is going to be so immense that you'll never have to work another day in your life. Now, El Story Simon outlines this in a 20-page document that he files with the court, and it was denied. But it's a blow-by-blow description of what these people did to shake him down. And he alternates between, am I going to never work again and reap millions after 2 years in jail, or am I going to allow myself to face the death penalty? He finally caves in. Cialino sits down and writes out a confession, and El Story Simon reads it, and Cialino videotapes it. Cialino jumps in his car with his pal, who's now deceased. They race back to Channel 2, and on air at 10 o'clock, and it shakes the absolute underpinnings of the Cook County Criminal Court justice system, and it shakes Dick Devine big time.
Yeah, and Dick Devine is the state's attorney of Cook County at the time.
Correct.
So, Anthony, this is a whirlwind. I mean, things are happening so fast it's hard to keep track. So Anthony Porter is essentially out of jail within 2 days, right?
Yes. So what happens is that Simon's
charged with murder.
He's driven to Chicago by his sister. He's interviewed by a few people. He's immediately charged with the killing. And Devine is under such incredibly immense pressure at this point, bearing in mind, by the way, that Devine was the editor of the Northwestern Law School newspaper, had, you know, very solid connections with the school, obviously. He's under immense pressure from the press. How can you dare not send a man who acknowledged that he pulled the trigger on TV away and allow Porter to remain behind bars. So Porter, you're right, is immediately popped loose provisionally. El Story Simon, believe it or not, then sticks with his confession.
Yeah, that's a hard one. It's okay, but anyhow, let's talk about Porter for a second. Anthony Porter, all of a sudden, achieves this kind of hero status. He's now the face of wrongful conviction and possible death penalty in Illinois. And George Ryan cited his case. A lot of the legislators cited his case. He became the driving force for repealing Illinois' death penalty law.
There is no question about that. Everybody will acknowledge that. And by the way, just as an aside, there are those who say that, and it's in my book as well, there are those who claim that protest was, you know, since an infant in Brooklyn, felt very uncomfortable with the death penalty, and all his young life and later life was fighting to eliminate death penalty, not just in Illinois, but across the country. You know what? I knew Dave. I used to work with Dave when I was at the Chicago Tribune. He was with Veteran Government Association. We worked side by side. And I got to tell you, he was a young man at the time, and I truly liked Dave. He was very, very bright, very, very quick on his feet, always coming up with good ideas. But I always believed that Dave was doing this for self-aggrandizement. And I will tell you something.
You're talking about investigating these cases for self-aggrandizement?
I'm sorry?
You said he was doing it for self-aggrandizement. Do you mean like pursuing these investigations?
Look at me. I'm on the front page of every newspaper.
Oh, he was. He was a superstar in Chicago, and it's my understanding that there were reporters out there who had some real questions about his tactics and about his results, but they...
You know, I'd like to know where those reporters are.
Well, I've heard that they didn't have the stomach to challenge him publicly.
Well, that's right. But again, another aside, you know, this tends to be nuanced as well. But here's an interesting point I always find interesting. When Anthony Porter went to trial. It was a three-day trial. It was a jury trial in criminal courts. And he did not testify. And he has every right to decline to testify. No issue there. But he puts on as his alibi witness a guy by the name of Fat Luke. Okay? So under cross-examination by the state's attorney, Fat Luke is asked, where were you when this shooting of these two people occurred? He said Anthony Porter and I and several of our friends were in the hole, which was an area of the Robert homes. They referred to it as the hole. And we were there all night long. We were drinking, smoking weed, and talking about the old times. Under further cross, the assistant state's attorney says, are you a member of a gang? Yes, I am. What do gang members do? He said, well, I'm no chief or nothing like that. He said, well, what did you do? He says, well, whatever had to be done. And the assistant said, well, does that mean fighting? And he says, yes. She then says, does that mean murdering? And he says, yes, ma'am. If asked to murder, I murder.
Okay. Now, just a dutiful member there.
Did any wonder that the jury came back with a guilty verdict?
No, this case was not a close case. It was, kind of a slow guilty plea, because the evidence is overwhelming and there's no question where the jury's going to go. So that's what made it kind of unusual, was that there wasn't really anything particularly unusual about this case.
And the jury was out for about 5 hours. They waited long enough to have dinner. They came back and they said guilty.
Okay. So anyhow, Anthony Porter finds himself as a kind of the hero of the state of Illinois. He's the face of wrongful conviction. And so he goes on with his life. Meanwhile, Al Story Simon is facing murder charges. And tell us about his lawyer. Who was his lawyer and how did he get the lawyer?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question. So
I'll say it is.
So El Story Simon is down in Danville for the first two of his original 37 years.
Oh, we haven't gotten to his trial yet.
I'm sorry?
We should back up to the trial, though. He had a guilty plea hearing. He pleaded guilty in court, and his lawyer was a guy named Jack Rimland. Where did he get Jack Rimland?
Oh, okay. So... Here's the only way I can explain this. There are about six principals who are key and directly related to this injustice. it's kind of a, it's a strangely somewhat silent conspiracy, but they're all on the same page. I do not believe that these people sat down beneath a tent somewhere and mapped this thing out meticulously, but they all, through a wink and a nod, agreed to play their roles in the ultimate outcome of this case. Jack Rimland was renting, he's a lawyer, he was renting office space from Paul Cialino, who's the private eye at the time. Mm-hmm. After Paul Cialino extracts this two-bit meaningless confession out of Elstory Simon, he calls from Simon's Milwaukee home, he calls Chicago, and he calls Jack Rimland, who is renting space out of his offices, and says, Jack, I've got a great case for you. Get up here right now. Now, I want to ask you one question. When's the last time you met a criminal defense attorney from Cook County who's going to get in his car on a Thursday morning in the middle of winter and drive from Chicago to Milwaukee to take a case from a man who is penniless?
It sounds like you'd have to do some pretty good talking.
Rimland gets in his car, and he goes up there, and Cialino introduces him to Porter and said, here's the guy, and here are the problems. Now, this is where things get a little rough, but just before Simon is put in jail, and I've lost that train of thought. Anyway,
you're talking about Rimland and his relations with Simon as his client,
right? But what Rimland does is he now remember he's running offices from Cialino, and he tells Simon the same thing that Cialino told him, and that is, you've got to plead guilty, you're only going to do 2 years, and immense amount of money is going to flow your way if you play the game. So two years go by.
So he takes, but he gets sentenced to 37 years, right? But he gets sentenced to 37.
Well, he was sentenced to 37 years,
yeah.
But he's now only done two.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
He's been told he's only going to do two because protests has got this immense influence, and he's going to get him out after 2 years, and he's going to reap all this money. So he's done his two, and he hears nothing from Rimland, from protests, from nobody. So he writes Rimland. He says, the 2 years are up. When am I getting out? And Rimland says, I no longer represent you. But here's what I was getting at. Now, let's see if you can bear with me here.
Okay.
Just before he goes to jail, there is a top assistant in Devine's office. His name is Tom Epak.
Right, I know that.
He is the chief of the criminal division.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls in a young, aggressive assistant by the name of Tom Gaynor, who is now an associate criminal court judge in Cook County. At the time, he's an assistant state's attorney. EPAC says to him, I don't know, in effect, I don't know what the hell's going on here. Who killed what? Who pulled the gun? Who shot these people? I don't know. Was it Porter? Was it Simon? Call an informational grand jury and get some witnesses before that grand jury and find out who pulled the trigger that night. Okay. Gaynor calls 12 people to the grand jury. The first six are the six original individuals who saw Porter pull the gun and shoot the two victims. At no time, once again, during this grand jury proceedings, do any one of these six persons who were in the pool say, well, it could have been Elstory Simon. I think I saw Elstory outside. His name is never mentioned. I saw protests pull the trigger.
I saw Porter pull. I saw Porter pull the trigger. You said protest.
Porter pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
Now he calls in the six students and protests. So he's got 12 in all. Six who saw the killing, six who investigated the killing. And you should see the testimony, you should read the testimony that these students give. It is absolutely ludicrous.
And it's in the book.
And if it weren't so terrible, it would be hilarious. They make absolute, utter, 100% fools of themselves. But again, when he's all finished, he has re-indicted and convicted Porter.
This is Tom Gaynor, who is now the judge.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He has vindicated Simon, and he's made fools out of Northwestern. Those are the underlying documents that if any reporter had read, he would realize, or she would realize.
Let me just back up a second again to Simon pleaded guilty, but as I was subsequently discussing with Simon's civil lawyer, Naperville lawyer Terry Eckel, he was saying that had Simon chosen to go to trial, had he come to his senses and said, no, I want a trial, I'm not guilty, that basically there was no evidence linking Simon to the shootings other than his confession. Now, it's also my understanding that a confession without corroboration is insufficient to support a guilty verdict. But basically, if the prosecutors had to take the case to trial like they did earlier with Porter, there's no way they would have prevailed.
But, amen. And that was one of the great many criticisms, obviously, of this wrongdoing. But that was another one. There was no attempt to lift a finger to determine, A, the veracity of the Simon confession, nor the circumstances under which it was extracted. Now, Cialino himself, and it's in the book, subsequently, a couple years later, gives an interview to Chicago Magazine. And in the Chicago Magazine, he says, I'm somewhat paraphrasing here, we danced him to the edge. He could not recover. Now, if one were to go into criminal court under those circumstances and describe how a confession was extracted by dancing one to the edge where he could not recover, that would have been thrown right out the nearest window, that confession.
But the interesting thing was that not only did Alstory Simon plead guilty, he stood up in the courtroom and he apologized to the family of the victim. So in your mind, he's still play acting there.
It's in the book, and in my mind, he is still play acting. And if you ever met this man, well, forget about that. The facts show clearly what had happened here. One must remember, and Al is a friend of mine, of limited education. He came out of the Robert Taylor Homes. At the end of the day, he's a solid guy. But here he's got somebody telling him that you're going to be worth millions and you're only going to do 2 years. And your alternative to that is that if you don't want the $2 million, and if you don't want to not to ever have to work again, your alternative is you're going to die in the of death because of the murder that you've committed. So he stands up and he gives a very somewhat eloquent, somewhat lengthy apology to the mother of the female victim, and apologizes not only to her, she's got the two grandkids in there, but he turns and apologizes to them as well. It's a very convincing apology. There's no question about it. But you raise a very good point, and it's in the book. At no time was there any effort to determine the merits of this confession, A, and the circumstances under which it was extracted. And had that taken place, number one, it would have been thrown out immediately.
Okay, let's see now. Alstory Simon is deciding reluctantly, he's coming to the conclusion that he's been had, and he starts his efforts to get out. And at some point, he ends up with a lawyer named Terry Eckel, who takes up his cause. But also, you stumble into this story. So tell me how you got involved in this story. I mean, it's not a simple thing to get involved in something to the degree that you write a book about it, but you did, and it was by accident. So explain that.
Okay. So just moving back just a tad, there are two retired ATF agents, alcohol, tobacco, firearm agents, and they are now licensed private detectives for Illinois. They had been doing some other work for other lawyers that was adverse to protesters' interests, namely the Fort Heights Four. They did a lot of work on that case. So they knew all about protests.
Mm-hmm.
One day they're sitting in their offices and they see a Channel 2 broadcast his confession that had been extracted by Cialino. And because they claim to be so familiar with, you know, the work of protests at all, they just look at one another. They take a puff on their cigars and say, what a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah, they're very skeptical.
So time goes by. They hop in their car. And by the way, they do a lot of work for, you know, various defense attorneys out this way in the western suburbs of Chicago. And Echol and Jim Soltos, Terry Echol and Jim Soltos, happen to be two lawyers for whom they did a lot of work. So they go down, they introduce themselves to Elstory Simon, and they ask him if they could have copies of his court records.
So they actually visited him in prison?
I'm sorry?
They actually visited him in prison.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And they got copies of all the court materials that had been generated at that point. They bring them back, and they read, guess what? The grand jury testimony, among many other things. And the minute they see that grand jury testimony, they realize the guy is bad. So, because they're close to Terry and Jim Soltos, because Terry and Jim Soltos are excellent attorneys, they take the materials to them. And they realize immediately, pursuant to the grand jury materials.
Now, are you talking about Gaynor's grand jury materials?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Gaynor's grand jury materials.
Mm-hmm.
They realize again that this was all a fraud, and they agree to take the case
mm-hmm.
on the come. And they file a lengthy document outlining just about everything we've talked about, and they file it with a Cook County judge requesting a rehearing on the Elstory Simon case. It's denied. It's denied summarily.
So the judge didn't want to hear it.
The judge did not want to hear it. So he's still down in Danville. He's going to do his 27 or whatever, 37. So now the two ATF agents go out and get yet additional materials. They take new statements from various people to bolster the position. They take it back to Terry and Soltos, and the two lawyers then file a second petition for a rehearing. And that one is denied in a lengthy 20 to 30 page opinion. So Elstory Simon is out of luck. Now, how did I get involved? I got a call from a former Chicago policeman who asked me if I would sit down with another Chicago policeman who felt he had been wrongfully accused of some stuff. I said, yeah, sure I will. So I sat down with him, and I said, this is all very interesting. Where are the records of your case? And he said they are with the two ATF agents, Jim DeLordo and Johnny Mazzola, out in Batavia where they have their offices. So I hop in the car, I drive out there, I say to Johnny and Jim, hey, my name is Bill Crawford. I'm here to take a look at the case. I'm told you guys got all the underlying records, a case completely different from Story Simon. And they say, yeah, we got all the records, but you're looking at the wrong case. And I said, well, just give me the records. So they gave them to me. I made three or four or five different trips back out to their office. Each time I went out there, Jimmy in particular, DeLordo, said, Bill, you're looking at the wrong case. You got to look at Story Simon. And I said, why would I look at Elstory Simon? They said, because he's been locked up for 15 years for a crime he didn't commit. And
what year was that now? What year? What year were you talking to these guys?
This is 2010.
Okay.
So anyway, Jimmy then says to me, by the way, he pleaded guilty to the crime, but he is innocent.
And you said, and I said, yeah, right.
I said, if you think I'm going to waste my time on a case like that, you got to be out of your mind. But then he gave me the grand jury materials and other materials, and I immediately dropped the initial case and went to work on the Simon case.
Why do you think that the Cook County courts were so reluctant to take a second look at that case when Echol and Sotos filed their petitions for a rehearing? I mean, it would seem to me the evidence would be substantially on their favor.
It would be pure speculation on my point, but I got to tell you, there's a certain dynamic in Chicago. You know it. You know of it. I lived it. I grew up with it. I reported on it for 40, 50 years. There was definitely a political consideration that had been made here. Now, wait a minute. Bear in mind, you've got a state's attorney who appears before, and I'm jumping ahead here, appears before the sentencing judge who's going to sentence Elstory Simon to 37 years, and he withholds information that he gleaned from that grand jury.
Now, this is Gaynor you're talking about.
He distorts evidence that he gleaned from that grand jury.
Was he a judge by this time?
And he mischaracterizes information he gleaned from that grand jury to that sentencing judge. But again, it took all four people. Rimland had to be in on it. The state's attorney had to be in on it. Cialino had to be in on it. Protest had to be on it. Had any one of those four persons, had Rimland stood up and said, Your Honor, we object to the confession that was extracted from my client because it was a forced confession, a confession. They claimed they were policemen. They were armed to the teeth. They even threatened him with harm. It's in Elstory Simon's petition. At one point, they said, accidents happen every day, even in one's own house. And if you don't play by the rules, an accident could happen this morning.
You know, Dick Devine always struck me as kind of a straight shooter when he was the Cook County State's Attorney. It blows my mind that he was willing to be stampeded by David Protest's publicity play, when in fact, if he had simply said, listen, let's take a deep breath and look at the evidence here, he could have blown him away, couldn't he?
Yeah, he could have. I mean, there's no question about it, but I have to tell you, he came out of Northwestern, and what one has to do to truly understand the kind of cultural saturation that was going on at the time with regard to this issue, it had been going on for years. The columnists were making heroes out of protests at all, and absolutely excoriating the state's attorney's office. And in my book, again, about this time, this very time, a five-part series comes out by the Chicago Tribune, by a dear good friend of mine, and three or four others.
So you're talking about the Devine being under the gun from the Tribune series. I think that was on death penalty cases that supposedly had been botched, and series was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Okay, so basically, you're saying he folded. He didn't have the stomach to confront Protus.
He didn't have the stomach to do it. And what really, really, just absolutely blows me away is he obviously got his hands on the grand jury materials.
Yeah.
And he obviously read that, and yet in the face of that, no action is taken.
Yeah, he said, well, better that Elstory Simon go to prison for a crime he didn't commit than I suffer further bad publicity. Is that about it? I mean, that's what it sounds like to me.
I think that's what it comes
to. I mean, that's a hard way to put it, but I think that's exactly the choice that he made. And anyhow, a lot of things going on here. But that series by the Tribune kicked up some trouble for Protest, didn't it, eventually? Because he found himself in hot water with Northwestern University over some litigation that grew out of that series somehow? What's the background there?
No. That devastating series occurs in 1999. Now, time goes by. Protest keeps up. He's banging away at, again, 30-year-old cases, going out and getting affidavits from people who signed the originals 30 years before, get them to change it, and again, promises to them of shortened prison sentences, money in the bank, etc. So there's yet another case, and it's called the McKinney case, Alfred McKinney. And now
I don't know why, but I don't remember that one.
No longer around. Anita Alvarez is now the Cook County State's Attorney, and she is starting to take a jaded, more skeptical look at what Northwestern is doing. So in the McKinney case, which begins to unfold under Alvarez, he's in jail for 30 years for having shot a security guard. The state's attorney under Alvarez now starts to turn on Northwestern and ask it questions about certain things. And now Northwestern is on the defensive. And protests is got his back to the wall. He's painted in a corner. And he can either tell the truth and make a fool out of himself, or he can lie. So he lies. And as the evidence of his lying about the McKinney case grows, Northwestern becomes very, very nervous.
Now, he was a hero at Northwestern. I mean, the university used him for fundraising purposes. He was the hottest thing going,
yeah.
Wasn't he?
Can you turn it up a little bit or no?
A while.
Can you turn the volume up or no?
I'm trying. I thought I was getting it done. How about now?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Sort of. So now the state's attorney starts turning on him. They start asking him questions.
And he lies.
He hires a high-powered attorney to defend him in these now defensive positions he finds himself in. His lawyer quits because the lawyer says, my client is not being truthful with me. So it all begins to crash in on protests. Now Northwestern hires Jenner and Block, one of the leading law firms in the nation, and Jenner and Block conducts a very expensive, a very thorough internal investigation on what protests has been doing in the McKinney case. Based upon that investigation, Northwestern fires protests.
So he's out. So he is now out of the picture.
He is out of the picture, and he turns around within days and opens up. He's now a private citizen. He's no longer a professor. He opens up his own Chicago Innocence Project at the time called CHIP and starts engaging in the same nonsense.
Okay,
but,
so
to get back to your question.
So how does Alstory Simon win his freedom?
Well, if you could turn that volume up a little bit, it might help.
I said, how does Alstory Simon win his freedom? I'm trying. I'm at about the top of my volume here, so I don't know what the problem is.
Okay. After my book comes out, and there was a documentary based upon my book. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, Murder in the Park was the movie.
Right. After all of this hits, Anita Alvarez, then the Cook County State's Attorney, in 2010, announces to the world that she's going to take a new look at what led to the conviction of Alstory Simon. They're going to look into his confession. They're going to look into everything that Devine should have looked at. And after a year's time, and after she calls more than 100 witnesses, one day she puts out a media alert announcing to the entire press in Chicago that she's going to hold a press conference, and it's going to have to do with Alstory Simon. The morning of the press conference at 9 o'clock, she marches in to the chief judge's chambers courtroom at Cook County Circuit Court and demands that Alstory Simon be freed immediately because it's a faulty conviction.
So he was not
two hours later, she holds a press conference. I was there. I almost got thrown out. And she announces to the world that because of the incredible conflict between Cialino owning the offices, Jack Lavin renting from him, protests promising movie rights, and there's even talk of sexual encounters and other favors, she said this confession cannot stand, and justice absolutely compels me to release this man from prison today. Elstory Simon walks out 2 hours later that morning, April 30, 2012, a free man.
So was she saying that Elstory Simon was, in fact, innocent, or just that we cannot?
And that's very interesting. She absolutely excoriates protests. She absolutely excoriates Divine. She stays away from the students. And she kind of leaves it up in the air as to whom may have done what to whom. But the next question is, what does Elstory Simon do after he gets out?
Well, that's when he filed the lawsuit, correct?
He files a lawsuit.
Against Northwestern and everybody else under the sun.
4 days ago, that lawsuit was settled.
Right.
For an undisclosed amount.
Right.
It was settled against Northwestern, or by Northwestern, and by protests. Protests went on the record saying, the legal fees are eating me alive. I can no longer afford this. That's the only reason I'm agreeing to settle. Northwestern is absolutely silent on it, pursuant to an agreement. Nobody knows what the final figure is. I have my guesses. It wasn't $40 million, but it was a healthy number. And Elstory Simon is now a free man. He's got money in his back pocket. And Northwestern has neither admitted or denied any guilt.
Here's what Northwestern had to say about it. Institutions routinely...
Pardon me?
Here's what Northwestern had to say about it. Let me just read this. Can you hear me okay?
Well, Northwestern has said nothing because they can't.
Well, a Northwestern spokesman said, institutions routinely settle lawsuits regardless of whether they are defensible. Other factors such as the time demands on the individuals involved, potential costs, long-term...
I can't hear you.
Okay. Basically said, we remain of the view that this case, which we have defended aggressively, is defensible. But they settled anyhow because they said we routinely settle all kinds of cases that are defensible.
Well, I mean, they can say what they want to say, but one point that you mentioned earlier, and it wasn't expanded upon by me, and that is one of the principal bases of the lawsuit that was brought by Terry Echol and Jim Sotos against Northwestern was that they looked the other way, knowing full well that all this wrongdoing was taking place. But they looked the other way because the journalism school had become world-renowned, quite literally, because of Protus's conduct, and students were standing in line to get enrolled in the Medill School of Journalism. But more importantly than that, money was being dumped on Northwestern from all kinds of charities, foundations, you name it, to the tune of millions and millions of dollars. And one classic example of that is the McCormick Foundation in 1998 cut a check to Northwestern just as the Elstory Simon case is beginning to bubble to the surface for $20 million.
So I just want to say, you talked about the McCormick Foundation giving them $20 million, giving Northwestern $20 million. So it was a good business for a while. And you actually had people in the journalism school who were deeply skeptical of protests, but they were kind of keeping their mouths shut. Where does Ken Bodie fit into all this thing?
Well, and by the way, I didn't talk to Ken. So what I'm giving you, and it's in the book, is sort of a general feeling about Ken Bodie at the time. And that is that he had a predecessor, Ken Bodie, And that predecessor, whose name escapes me at the moment because he's not real central to everything,
mm-hmm.
And it goes back in time, but his name is on the tip of my tongue. But his father was a fabled columnist across the country. And then the son came into the game, and the son, for a while, was the head of the Medill School of Journalism. I talked to his daughter, and he is now deceased, but the daughter told me that he would come home from work night after night and complain about sort of the perilous work that he thought that protests was involving himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he went to higher-ups at Northwestern in an effort to get him removed from the class, and the class removed from
the curriculum
being taught.
Mm-hmm.
I am told that he was promptly dismissed, and he's no longer alive, and Bodie was replaced him because Bodie was one of his heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the tail end of the book, we also get into this, and that is that there was kind of a schism. There were those who thought that Protus was an absolute hero, was doing the right thing, and was wrongfully being mm-hmm. accused of mm-hmm. These various accusations. There was another half of the faculty and others who believed that he was way, way off base.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it turned out that he was way, way off base.
One of those people who idolized protests is Chicago Tribune columnist Eric Zorn, who last week wrote a scathing column in Fight for Truth, Northwestern Surrenders. And in this column, he not only calls out Northwestern for settling a case that he thinks they should have fought to the bitter end, but he lambasts this idea that protests was up to no good. He said, lawyers friendly to law enforcement took up Simon's cause and helped fund a documentary that accused protests and Cialino of masterminding a wicked, highly convoluted plot to frame an innocent man and free a stone-cold killer in order to advance the cause of death penalty abolition. It was a right-wing fantasy, paranoid fantasy, worthy of Alex Jones, but then Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez bought it. I'm not sure how he comes up with the right-wing, left-wing thing,
well,
but...
I wonder if his back isn't to the wall. I don't know. I mean, they're down to 200,000 employees, or 2,000 employees at that paper. There were 8,000 when I was there.
Yeah.
They just moved out of Tribune Tower, and they're in Suite 11 at 3 South Wacker or some damn place. I'm wondering if he's not, fighting for his life. I will tell you this. All I would ask Zorn to do is read the statement
mm-hmm.
that was given by Northwestern when protest was fired, and it is absolutely it makes no attempt to apologize to anything. They allege that he destroyed documents, that he altered documents, that he lied to the university, that he lied to his fellow faculty, and it goes on. And guess what? That's part of the Jenner and Block report, and the Jenner and Block report has never been made public, mm-hmm. and it will never be made public. And one of the reasons, in my view, that Northwestern settled this friggin' case is because the last thing in the world they wanted was to have to produce the Jenner and Block statement had this thing going to trial.
But there
and
were...
I'll tell you what else they didn't want to listen to or read about on the front pages, and that are these allegations, and they're in the public record. I'm not pulling this out of a cloud someplace. He was engaged in all kinds of frivolous, irrelevant, having to do with females kind of conduct, and here comes Zorn in the face of the statement that was given by Northwestern when they fired him. And it's an absolute contradiction to what Zorn is writing. I don't know whether Zorn is smoking some or what he's doing.
No, he's part of the faction of journalists in Chicago who are blindly supporting or zealously supporting. I mean, I guess he would say he's not blind, but is protest pretty much discredited in the eyes of Chicago journalists now? Does everybody realize they were taken for a ride?
No. Well, you know what? In my view, internally, they are. Are they going to write a candid piece pointing out all the wrongdoing that has occurred with regard to reporting over the last 10 years? And are they going to say, and by the way, we'd like to thank Bill Crawford for bringing this to light. It ain't going to happen. internally, perhaps, but you're never, ever, well, Zorn is an example. You're never, ever going to see a candid mea culpa by anybody.
Well, it fits with the settlement. I mean, they just put this thing, they wrapped it up, and they buried it deep, and nobody's ever going to really know anything.
What one must remember
in terms of the settlement
case, and there have been maybe 15 or 20 depositions taken in the case.
Mm-hmm.
All the depositions are under seal.
Right.
They will never make it to the public eye because of it's now a moot case. But I will tell you this: I didn't read any of them because they were under seal. But I certainly heard about some of them, and I'm telling you, the last thing Northwestern wanted to do was read some of the deposition material that would have come from, you guess it, 4, 5, 6 former female students who were working arduously and courageously at protest aside to free all these innocent people.
Well, they're not the only, Northwestern's not the only people or institution that had something to lose. I mean, this Judge Gaynor, who was the guy who took the grand jury, Dick Devine, who was the state's attorney, Anita Alvarez, I guess.
Here is the greatest mystery to me. Here you have a man who's an assistant state's attorney, he's not an associate judge, but at the time he's a prosecutor. He is sworn to represent the people of Illinois at the sentencing of Elstory Simon. He has heard testimony, I've said this, from 6 individuals who said they were all in the pool, they all saw some aspect of the shooting of the victims. And you know what he says to the judge? And it's in my book. He tells the judge, Your Honor, had this case gone to trial, the state would have called the following 3 people as key witnesses. And he names the 3 individuals who are among the 6 individuals who testified under oath that they saw Porter shoot the 2. Now he's telling the sentencing judge that he's going to call them as witnesses. I mean, why hasn't he been indicted?
Well, Chicago is a great city for cover-ups, and I think that's what we got here. It's the mystery that's not going to be solved. I just have a couple more questions for you. Anthony Porter is a free man. Is he behaving himself?
Oh, well, let's put it this way. Elstory Simon was out, and it's in my book.
No, not Elstory Simon, Anthony Porter.
Excuse me. Anthony Porter was out for about 2 months, and the first thing he did, he beat the living daylights out of his girlfriend, okay? And it was very, very ugly, and there was a lot of blood and blah, blah, blah. So he got probation. Why, I don't know. It was down at Kankakee. And then not so long after that, he's with another woman, and she breaks an armrest on a car that he has just bought and practically kills her. But other than that, he's been behaving himself.
Okay, that's very good. And here's my last question. Why did they almost throw you out of the press conference that Anita Alvarez held?
Well, as I was coming in, a couple of these people know what I look like and who I am. And
these people, who are these people?
Press only. And I was with a policeman off duty. So he and I, sat down it was unbelievable because there were about, I don't know, maybe 15 representatives of the press out there. And I am telling you, Jim, not one of them had a clue what this case was about.
Yeah.
I mean, the underlying
sure.
meaningful stuff. So I started asking questions about the grand jury materials.
Uh-huh.
And one of these goofy nitwits from the press said, shut up. And I ignored him. And I said to Anita, I said, how about the grand jury? Did you get into the grand jury material? Where Gaynor did thus, no, we didn't talk to the grand jury. And suddenly, what's her name? I've forgotten. Her chief spokesman comes over, and she weighs about 300 pounds more than I do. And had she been able to get to me, she would have strangled me, because she knew I wasn't with the press. She certainly knew who I was, but she couldn't get to me, so she couldn't throw me out. And on the way out, they were just, throwing barbs at us and everything else. So that's that.
Well, so you were kind of an unwelcome messenger, huh?
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, I think your message is a good one, even if the state's attorneys that people didn't want to hear it. But the story is a fascinating one, and unfortunately, it doesn't have an ending. But the book is Justice Perverted. It's a heck of a story. It's a 40-year saga, which. Really is kind of, it's hard to believe this actually happened, but you know, in Chicago, all kinds of, and Illinois, all kinds of unbelievable things happen all the time.
Well,
so
I was on Rick Hogan's talk program, and he said to me when I finished, I was only on there for 15 and a half hour. He said, you know what? He said, you could take this to Hollywood and they throw you out the back door because they wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's very, 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 very odd, but interesting. And so thank you so much, Bill Crawford.
Well, I appreciate it.
For joining us.
I appreciate the time. And again, my thanks to you.
Well, you're certainly welcome. And the book is a heck of a good one. Some fantastic reporting here, the best of what journalists have to offer society. And so once again, thank you. And thank you to our audience for listening in. And
that's
all we have for today. So long.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.